Hey, Culture Hackers, it's Robbie Richman here, and I'm really excited about this one because we are going to be talking about the culture of procrastination, and who doesn't deal with procrastination? I mean, it's everybody, I think, and we're going to take it apart from a hacking perspective of how we can hack procrastination. We're here with Shirley Aylor Asif. She's born and raised in Israel, licensed clinical psychologist specializing in addiction, procrastination, and relationships. What a magic combination there. Following her doctoral research of academic procrastination at CSPP in Los Angeles, she was a postdoctoral fellow at TTC Tarzana, a psychiatric hospital specializing in substance abuse treatment. And now she's currently in Studio City at her clinic, and she provides psychotherapy to individuals, couples, and groups. And she also gives talks and workshops and writes about this. And that's actually how I found about her, through Daniel Hausman and the Be Not Talks. Mm-hmm. So it's fantastic. If anything goes wrong with this, I'm going to totally slander Daniel. So you're off the hook. It's all on Hausman.
That's a deal.
Right? So welcome to the Culture Hackers Podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm so thrilled to be here.
Yeah. This is going to be fun. So how'd you get into all this?
How did I get into all that? Okay, well, this is kind of self-revealing, but really? Usually when you do a research, it's about something that is of interest, that is close to you. For me, procrastination, academic procrastination, was something that I have known firsthand experience for many years. Always dealt with it until I got to my doctorate writing. And as a procrastinator, you're usually very good at cramming in the last minute, making it, reaching the deadline, just, you know, barely, but doing it. But when you have a big, big project, you can't just cram.
Right. What do you tend to do when you procrastinate? Like, I clean everything. Like, because I feel like that's not bad. Like, I'm actually doing something productive, but I can't stop cleaning when I don't want to do something.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's classic. There's a pattern when you procrastinate.
Really?
Yes. And there's a cycle. It's kind of entertaining, unless you are the one who's procrastinating. But it always starts when you have the project. You're always very optimistic and you say, okay, this time it's going to be great. This time I'm going to do it right on time. I'm going to be organized. I'm going to have my schedules. It looks very bright and great.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the time passes and you didn't do anything. And then we come to the next stage where you're a little bit less optimistic and the ideal date to start passed already and you didn't do anything. And now you start to feel the doubt that, oh, maybe it's going to be like that, just like the rest of the time. It's maybe I'm not going to make it on time this time. But still, you are not able to motivate yourself to actually come from the realm of ideas to the realm of action.
Yeah.
And then we come to the next phase. And the next phase is exactly what you talked about, is that we start doing everything else. And the reason that we do that, there's a reason for that, is first of all, it takes off some pressure because you really want to do something. Yeah. You just don't want to do the thing that you need to do because it's too scary, because there's so many things around. It's like a hot potato. You don't want to touch it. You just, you know, go around it. So you start doing many things and you find your closet and you start going hiking and you even study for something else.
Yes.
Anything and everything suddenly looks very important and urgent and you need to clean your desk right now.
Right.
And it relieves some of the pressure.
Yeah.
And this is interesting also because many people from the side, the people who live with a procrastinator or work with a procrastinator, it seems like the procrastinator is aloof. They do nothing and they don't care. But there's a lot going on inside, because inside a lot of very, very negative feelings are coming. Feelings of shame and doubt and anger and frustration, feeling that I'm trapped, despair. How can I not break this, you know, cycle? And part of it also is the hiding, because when I feel ashamed that I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do and people are counting on me and thinking that I'm doing it, and we're sometimes very good at creating the illusion that we're actually making some progress when in fact we're not. So then we start hiding, so we won't answer the text of the other people asking, hey, what's going on? And if we know that we're going to go to a certain place and we'll meet the people that may ask us, so we're going to avoid that place. And it's like a cycle almost of isolation, because I cannot tell anyone that I'm not really doing what I'm doing. I'm too busy in keeping the facade that something actually happens, that the progress happens.
Wow.
Yes. And then we move to another stage, which is we're almost there and we still didn't do anything. And it's very scary. And now a lot of feelings of maybe the problem is in me. Maybe something core basic trait that I missed that so many other people have. Maybe I lack the reliability or the confidence or the intelligence or the whatever it is that other people have, may seem to have, and they can do it and I cannot. So now we shift from the problem is the project to the problem is in me. I'm faulted. I'm damaged in some way. And this is very painful because every time we go through this cycle, it shifts a little bit more from our self-esteem and the way we perceive ourselves.
Yeah.
And then finally we get to the, you know, really like the almost the deadline. And here we either have to do it or to run away. And oftentimes people will start doing it. So the last, you know, night before the test, there were all the project that will start cramming and doing. And oftentimes they will discover that it's not so bad.
Right.
And then they tell themselves, why did I wait so long? Why did I kill myself with the fear and the anxiety and all these things? I could have done it so much earlier. It's not that bad. And sometimes we flee and we say, no, we're not going to do it. And then we have, in both cases, we have a huge relief. Even though if I chose to do it, now my standards are much lower because I cannot aim to do this perfect project. Now I barely want to deliver it, you know, very like bone and skin.
Right.
Afterwards, it's a relief. And then the promise, I will never do it again. The next time's going to be different.
Yeah.
And this is a cycle.
Wow. Wow. And it, at the core of it, is it always fear?
It's fear. I mean, at the core of many things that we do as human beings is right. Fear, because fear is our best friend. It keeps us alive in so many levels. But I would say, well, here's the thing. In the past, something interesting about procrastination. Procrastination wasn't really researched until the last 20 or 25 years. And we have, we can see like in the Bible, in old, in Buddhist scripts, in Egyptian scripts, there's reference for procrastination, which tells us that procrastination is a very, very ancient phenomena. It has been with us for a long, long time. So the question is coming, why wasn't it researched for such a long time if humans dealt with it all the time? And the reason was that before like the quarter of the century, people thought that procrastination is due to being lazy, being irresponsible, being unreliable, maybe stupidity, lack of intelligence, I cannot plan ahead. So there was a moral judgment on it. The person who does that lacks this and this and this. This is the reason they do it. There's nothing to research.
Yeah.
And after 20 or 25 years, when we started doing the research and gathered the data, we actually realized that the reasons for procrastination are actually very, very different. It's not being lazy and hedonist and impulsive and not caring. It's actually it's correlated with being a perfectionist. It's correlated with anxiety and fear of change. It is heavily, heavily correlated with learning disabilities, problems with organizational skills, you know, frontal lobe, prefrontal lobe, I should say, and fear of change. So it is very different. It's a very different picture. You'll see it also with ADD, impulsivity. People have difficulties to concentrate and focus. You will see procrastination there.
Yeah.
So now when we know it, it's a little bit different. Now we can treat it.
So with that cycle you mentioned, fascinating cycle, that point where you said, oh, why was I delaying this so long? Like I could have just done. Can this be hacked just by doing it?
Okay. This is a $1 million question. You know, when I lecture people, oftentimes I will have someone who will just say, you know, you just need to do it. Just do it, and I can. But this is the core. This is the basic core of problem for a procrastinator. They cannot just do it. They really, really want to do it. They really want it to be that simple, but they just cannot. And all the fuss is around that and all the anxiety.
Well, I don't know. I guess I take issue with that word. I mean, that I saw this Israeli homeopath who mm-hmm. used to be a soldier, and he was telling this story about, like, they were in a war situation, and one of the guys had asthma and got asthma attacks, mm-hmm. and they were in a position where, like, a noise would give away their position, and it was literally like their lives at stake. So he pulled out his gun, put it to the guy's head, and said, "If you have an attack, like one more right now, you will give away your position." And like clicked it and just said, "You have one more, and you are gone." And the guy did not have an attack, you know. And so when you say that they can't, like. You're telling me they had a gun to their head, like they're saying, "I'm sorry, my limbs just don't work. I literally cannot do this."
Okay, so, well, the poor guy. I feel for that guy in the example that you gave. It can be pretty traumatic. Yes, if you will push it to the extreme, then definitely people will do things.
So they can do it.
Of course. They are able. They are capable of doing it. If this is a question, yes, definitely. The question is, the problem in procrastination, or the key is motivation. How do I make myself do things that I want to do? Because we're not even talking about things that we are forced to do,
right,
or coerced to do. These are things that we chose. These are things that we said, "Hey, I want to do that." And yet it is so hard to do it. So the reason is, most of the research is actually on the motivation. Oftentimes you will see research about motivation, a lot of research in economy, by the way, about procrastination, basically about how people procrastinate dealing with their securing their future, their financial future, because this is so prevalent. Many people are doing that. The problem is the motivation. What happens with this person and with that task that we are unable to motivate ourselves? And motivation research shows you several things. First of all, the strongest motivation, the one that you can really rely on, is internal. Meaning, if I feel that I do it for myself, if I feel that I chose it, if I feel that I can do it the way I want, odds are that I will procrastinate less about it. If I feel that I'm doing it for someone else, if I feel like I'm being forced to do it, or not very bluntly, but maybe, you know, subtly by someone, I will procrastinate. Now, another thing is that before we talk about procrastination and motivation, we actually have to think about how that person, how that individual perceives himself in the world. How does they perceive the world? In general. So we're talking about a mindset. And with the procrastinator's mindset, you oftentimes see like several distortions. One of them, or maybe several of them. And one of them, the one I think that I hear the most is, it has to be perfect.
Yes.
If it's not perfect, it's not worth doing at all. Yeah. I mean, oftentimes we heard it from important people in our lives.
Oh, I've been feeling that. I've been feeling it.
Yeah. So the perfect. And perfect is a word that I really hate. I mean, every time I hear perfect, I will say, cross it out and just replace it with the best I can. Because the best I can is something feasible, is something that I can actually do. Perfect, however, it's oftentimes it's not even economic, and I will explain. We have the Pareto rule, principle, if you're familiar.
80-20?
Exactly. Actually comes from economy. But if we apply it for behavior, roughly, on an average task, it will take me 20% of the time to fulfill 80% of the task. In most of the things that we do. In order to perfect the task, to make it perfect, wonderful, beautiful, flawless, I have to invest for that extra 20% that I have to invest 80% of the time. So this is something very, it's not economic. Now, there's a lot of waste in it, because how often do we need a task to be perfect? Now, of course, if I'm going to a brain surgery and the surgeon said, "You know what, I'm going to apply the Pareto rule. I'm going to do 80-20 hours and I want you to do a perfect job. This is a life and death." But here's the thing. How often do we do things that are life and death? Why can't we just provide a better version?
Right.
And later on, add to it, change it?
Well, it's an interesting point from the perspective of that 80, getting that. Because there's this quote, I think it's this Chinese proverb that says, the person who has gone 90% is halfway there. And I found that with writing my book, I was like, oh my God, I got the 90% of it done. And the last 10% took that much effort. Mm-hmm. And it makes me wonder, you know, if part of the problem is like that brain surgeon is not taking on five different jobs. You know, they've got assistants for things. They've got they really focus well. And one of the things I love about the Steve Jobs story is when he came back to Apple, he saw they were doing a million different products. They were crappy. He just canceled them all and said, we're doing four. We're doing pro level, consumer level, laptop, desktop, four. And that's it. And they rocked it, you know, and they made it solid. So as part of the procrastination problem, do you think that we don't limit ourselves to really putting effort and care into a few things? And instead, in this day and age, we can take on so many. I mean, I'll speak for myself. I've got my speeches. I've got my podcast. I've got my blog. I've got the workshops I do. I've got a membership site that I'm working on. I've got, you know, mastermind groups I want to do, et cetera. And so part of me thinks, is that part of the problem, that I'm not reducing them such that I could have the chance to really do something, not perfect, but let's say excellent?
Okay, so yes, of course. I mean, and this taps to another thing. It taps to the limit, the fantasy that we have no limits. I mean, oftentimes you will see with procrastinators the feeling that I'm just going to take this project. I'm not going to do anything until I finish it. And then we go to reality and we can't, because, you know, we get tired. Our motivation dies. We have previous engagements. We have different roles in our life. There's so many things. There's life in the middle that we have to deal with. So once again, if it's something very, very important, if it's a life and death, we want to aim for perfect. But if, like you, I'm trying to do many things, I'm trying to be versatile, I'm trying to you know, conquer different corners at the same time, is it feasible for you to do everything perfect or excellent? I mean, it's going to come on the expense of something else.
Yeah.
And is this a price that you're willing to pay? Now, if it's something very, if I have to save someone, I always will go to that to make it extreme, to show you that the effort, the level of effort sometimes is not worth it. Sometimes the quantity, and I know people hate to hear that, but quantity is important. I mean, we need to be able to get through this and this and this and this throughout our day, throughout the year, throughout whatever. If I'm going to do one thing perfect and all the rest will be neglected, then is it worth it for me? And this is something that, you know, that anyone does their calculation.
So do you do that with people? Do you actually like have them think about and write out all the things they're doing and have them think about reducing them?
Yeah. Okay. There's a very nice tool that we call the unschedule. And the unschedule is actually, you take a calendar, you take a schedule, an empty one, and you just fill inside all the things that you know that you're doing every day. The times that you eat and the times that you commute and the times that you work and the times that you sit on your blog and the TV show that you want to see and the time that you're on Facebook and every little thing that you do, you put inside there. And then once you filled it for a whole week, you look at it and it kind of gives you a reflection of the week ahead of you, how it's going to look like. And oftentimes when you do it with a person, they get, it's an eye opener. Sometimes the person says, wow, I have all this, not a lot of people, I have all this free time. I have all this dead time. Many people say, wow, I can't believe that I do all these things. Some people will say, wow, I never have alone time. I'm always with people in a social situation. Another person will say, oh my goodness, I hardly see people. I'm always doing these things. So first of all, you get to see what you do.
Yeah.
After that, you get to see when is your free time. And I'm talking about a project, if there's something that I want to do. Because what we usually procrastinate is the things that are not urgent, is the things for the future, is the important things that we need to do that are not, you know, we have to do them right now. So it's very easy to push and say, oh, I want to do it next week. I'm going to do it when I have time. We'll never have time. It will never change. We have to carve the time. We have to actively create the time for it. And I can give you an example for myself. When I had to do my doctorate, I said, okay, I'm going to sit every morning for 6 hours and I'm going to do it. And then I look at my schedule. And after I looked really, really carefully, I realized that I have barely 2 hours in the morning to do it with all my jobs and all the other things that I had to do. And that was an eye-opener because now I could plan.
And do you think, you know, there's that old adage that says, if you want something done, give it to the busy person, you know, yeah. And it makes me wonder if it's like, if, if being busy helps for that. Do you think it, like, is it that case where busy people are just more efficient?
Yes, I think I know what you're referring to. I think it's the time that we say we clear everything in order for us to be able to do something, and then we find ourselves midday still not getting there.
It's happening for me. It really does. I've got a lot of free time in this kind of role. Exactly. And that, yeah.
Exactly. And then the time that you're very busy and you have to squeeze something inside, then you find yourself very efficient because you know exactly that you have this amount of time and you have to be, it has to be done by that. So yes, definitely being busy helps you because it gives you a structure. It makes you actually look down at the nitty-gritty and say, okay, how much time do I really have? What do I have to do in this time? Deadline is your best friend. Without a deadline, we will do nothing.
Oh yeah. You know, the only way I got the book done was I said I was going to announce the book at a conference and I needed the book done by then. And one of the editors I was working with, she was like, it's not ready, this and that. I'm like, it doesn't matter. We are shipping. And that's what got it done.
That's a wonderful example. You did two things, actually. You did the, you also added the commitment. It wasn't only a deadline. You also committed. You had to announce it. Once you announced it, no, there's no way back.
Yeah. The first time I did this was with a small book called Create Your New Career that I give to people who want to create their jobs for themselves. And I worked on this with a coach, and he really applied the leverage for this one. We're sitting down. He's like, so you want to write a book? I'm like, yeah. He's like, what's that date that we can do it by that like is going to be comfortable but aggressive? And I'm like, a month. And he said, okay, what will be done within a month? And I said, okay, I want the book, the website up, and like an email opt-in. And he said, okay, great. And now, and then he said, tell me an organization you hate. And I'm like, an organization I hate? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, I don't know. And he starts Googling his online. He's like, he finds this like supremacist, white supremacist group that just looked, you know, not the kind of person I'd support. And he's like, okay, write me a check to this group. And like, we got their name and everything. And I think it was $300. I wrote a check for $300 to this group. And he said, I'm going to hold on to this check. And if it's not done within a month, I'm sending this check. And I was like, hold, I got that thing done 5 days early. Five wow. days early.
That's very nice. That's very Pavlovian.
Right.
Yes.
It works.
Yes. He gave you a very, very unpleasant stimuli and you had to respond to avert it. Definitely. Yes. Yes. So this is also another way, but... But it's fun. You know what? I like that. It's creative. I don't know if this is something to apply in therapy, but I don't argue with success. And obviously it was successful.
Right.
But, you know, when we talk about procrastination, it's not only the perfectionism and everything. It's and the limit and the time. I mean, you can give a procrastinator all the skills of time management and the organization and everything, and they will still procrastinate.
Yeah.
Because this is one part of it. And it's actually the less important part, if you ask me, because this is something that anyone can go and learn somewhere. The important thing is to shift your mind and to move from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset.
Interesting.
Yes. And what do I mean by that? A fixed mind, and I have to quote a research on that. And this is a very famous research by Carol Dweck. And he did her research on fifth graders. And he took children. And each child got a very easy puzzle to make, to solve. And they were divided into two groups. One group, when the kids finished the puzzle successfully, were told, wow, you're so smart. Look how smart you are. You did it. And this is a fixed compliment or trait. The other group, every time a kid finished a puzzle, an easy puzzle, successfully, they would say, wow, look at the job that you did. You made so much effort. You worked until you solved it, which is something different. Here we praise being intelligent, being smart, or you can add like being pretty, something that we have no idea how we became this way and we have no control over, and we were probably all born with this. And especially for children, they don't know how to become less pretty or more pretty or less smart or more smart.
Right.
And the other group was praised for the process, for the learning, for the effort, which is actually detached from the end result. Mm. The next stage was to give the children a much harder puzzle. after they solved it, one group was praised for being smart, intelligent. The other group was praised for the work that they did. At the end of the experience, he gave them, the kids were presented with a choice to continue with the easy puzzles or to continue with the harder puzzles. Now, guess what happened? Most of the kids in the fixed mindset group, we'll call them the smart ones, yeah. They will pick the easy one. They will avoid the challenge. The children, however, who were praised for the effort, they always choose to go with the harder puzzle. They embraced the challenge. And this is exactly the difference between, and these are the terms that he actually coined, the fixed mindset and the growth mindset. Mm. What a different perception on life, yeah. on challenge, on ourselves. Here we take the process and we pull it up and we say it's not important if you succeeded or not. It's important the way, because this time you may have failed, the next time you will succeed. This is something that if the culture embraces, it affects all the parts in it. The other part, the other group, they once you get this fixed mindset and you get a crown of being intelligent, smart, whatever it is, now there's something for me to lose. Once an adult told me that I'm smart, I may fail somewhere and then they will take away the crown from me. I don't know how to become smarter. I don't know what I did to be smart. So I have no control over it. So you can see how anxiety provoking it is, because now I have something that I really have to hold in tight to, and I can always lose it, because if I fail, then they take it away. So this is process, and this is based on accomplishments.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so how is there a way that you make that active for people?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, first of all, we all learn these things somewhere. And that somewhere is usually home. I mean, home is the first, you know.
Well, I just wanted to say on that there's this interesting idea that, have you heard of nonviolent communication?
A little bit.
It's interesting. They have this idea that any judgment is not constructive. So when I say you are brilliant, that's still a judgment. Mm-hmm. And they said that the truth is, I don't know, like I'm not in a position to judge you, but I am in a position to say how I feel and how things affect me. Mm-hmm. So I can say, wow, Shirley, when you talked about that process, I felt really lit up because I can see how much that helps me. Mm-hmm. And that's the truth, as opposed to just putting a judgment on you, whether it be good or bad. Because if we're going to go for brilliant, if you're a brilliant person, then another person's a stupid person. And then all of it is essentially violent.
Exactly. And also now I have something to lose. Maybe I will say a very stupid thing the next minute, and I'm not going to be that brilliant anymore.
Right.
Definitely, yes. Judgment is a burden. Judgment is a burden. Even if it's positive or negative, it's a burden.
Totally.
You want to stick to, you know, other things. So, you know, when you look at the mindset in a culture, you want to promote the growth. You want to put the emphasis and the focus and the spotlight on the process, regardless of what it yields. We may have nothing. We may have a failure. We may have something that is okay. But we want to promote the process, because the process will lead to challenge embracing, lead to innovation, will lead to risk-taking, lead to finding new ways to do same old things.
I love that. And I'm curious how much principles apply to this, because what I'm doing on two podcasts ago, I talked about one podcast ago about anti-marketing, what I call it, which is all about how the strongest companies that I've seen out there start intentionally small, like Tesla, like Facebook. You couldn't get them for years, even though you heard about them, which is different from the, hey, everybody buy my stuff, right? And so I've been working on these, I've got this right in front of me because I've got a client for this, product marketing principles. So one is steady intentional growth outlasting explosions. Another is experience and feeling drive success, or the first 90 days wins a customer for life. And so these things result in a totally different approach as opposed to the results, mm-hmm. and or result focus rather. So the way that I talk about this and teach this, I haven't used the word process, but I've used the word principles, because if we align with those principles, the experience becomes very authentic and worth it. So have you, is that something you use as well, or am I doing semantics when it comes to this?
Yes, I think it's very, it taps exactly on the same idea. Okay. I mean, you can call it process, you can call it principles, you can call it many things, but the idea is the same, basically. We want to look at the way. I think it's also a very nice a way to treat people and to treat ourselves. If we look at, I don't know, I'll give you an example of a child who starts walking. I mean, and they do their first steps, and if the mother will say, oh, you just fell, or it was wobbly, or you didn't do it so great, what are the odds that the child would try again, if he even understands what she told him?
Right.
But then with children, and this is something that I really like, because oftentimes we do things with children that I wish that we've done with ourselves. And the way we talk to children, and I talk about small children, and the way we talk to ourselves, our inner voices sometimes can be so harsh and so punitive.
Yeah.
And sometimes we talk to ourselves in a way that we won't allow anyone to talk to us, but we do it. And I will tell my clients, you know, take a picture of yourself when you were a kid, a very young kid, tender age, put it in a place you can see, and every time you have this harsh, you know, internal voice coming up, look at the child and talk, give that a narrative the way you will talk to a child, with empathy and with softness, and you can still convey the same message. I mean, process is important, and we have to give space for the process to happen, and we have to have patience, and we have to let things, you know, take time, and we have to allow space for trial and error. If we have this rigid, there's only one way, it has to lead for success. And this is, by the way, another reason for procrastination, the belief that there's only one truth and I'm going to wait until I find it. Mm. There's only one way to succeed, and I'm going to have to find it and do it. I mean, how boring.
Wow. So that's like a false belief. Only one way. Are there other false beliefs there?
Well, this is one of them. And the limit, the fantasy of being having infinite resources, which we can't have. But let me go back for a minute with the one way of success. I mean, I'm thinking again, when we were children and we see our home and we see our parents, say, okay, this is the way to live and this is great and this is the best thing. And then we go out and we grow up a little bit and we go to our friends and we get to see other ways of living. And then when we open our eyes and we're old enough to understand, say, hey, oh my goodness, this is another way and it may be even better. There's other ways to do the same thing. And same applies for cultures and for organizations. We grow up and say, okay, this is the way to succeed. This is the way to handle a successful organization. When in fact, there are so many other ways. There's so many models that can work. We have to, first of all, open, you know, these covers, like the horses have these covers, to open them, to see all the ways, which also brings back the joy and the fun, because now we can be creative. Now we can be flexible. Now I can try one route and maybe come back because I don't like it. Or I can go with this one. This is so nice. I'm going to do it again. Or maybe I'm going to make a shortcut to the other way. So I can do so many things and enjoy it at the same time, which is very, very important, because fun is a sacred word.
And since you said, since you said it's a pattern that we go through, do you have certain tools for pattern interrupts that would hack this?
Okay, yes. So when we talk about patterns, I think the root is, I would say the root is thought, word, action, meaning. It starts with a thought, the things that I'm thinking, the narrative that I have about the world, about myself, about what I need to do or shouldn't do. Then it goes to words, the way I talk. Like oftentimes with a perfectionist, you will hear a lot of I should, I need to. They never I want to. You don't hear a lot of I want to. I hear I should do it, I need to do it, I gotta do that. So when you hear the terminology, and oftentimes it sounds like, oh, this is very petty, you look at the word it really reflects the way I think, that my whole set of values, I can see that. Now, from the thought, we move to the word, and from the word, we will move to an action. Because the things I say, there's many chances that this is the things that I will do eventually. I mean, it starts with a plan somewhere. So the way to change patterns is to change first the thought, the mindset. When I start thinking differently, I may be still doing the same things that I'm doing, the same, you know, dysfunctional behaviors. But now I think differently. Now when I go through that automatic habit of, I don't know, whenever I need to do something, to go and open my Facebook account and start looking at my feed, I may have another thought telling me, maybe I should do it in 10 minutes. Maybe I can start in 10 minutes, dedicate 10 minutes now to the project. Only 10 minutes, not more than that, just 10 minutes, because it's anxiety provoking, because I want to do it, because it feels so bad and all the things. Now I just have the thought. And this will be one tool that I will say, take a big project, cut it to many small steps, and make the first step 5 minutes only. It has to be something easy and something short and something quick. We want to have a quick success that we can put under our belt. So now I have the thought. So I may not be doing that, but I have it there. So what happens is the automatic process, which is the pattern, is being disrupted. Now there's something else. I may be not doing it yet, but I'm thinking about it. Later on, I will be talking about it, as you did with the commitment, with the announcement, mm-hmm. which was, I think, brilliant. And the final step will be to actually do it, to say, oh, I'm going to do this first. But it starts in the head. Very important. It starts with the way we are thinking.
Nice. Nice. I like that. That's awesome. And so, And do you think, like, when people try to medicate this type of thing, is that sometimes I wonder if that, and I'm speaking from experience with this too. I mean, whether it be chocolate or when I've used ADD medication, those kind of things, sometimes it works really well, and other times it makes me just feel much better that I'm procrastinating. I still procrastinate, but I just don't feel guilty about it. And that's one step nicer than beating myself up for all the procrastination.
It's true. And by the way, addiction and procrastination go hand.
Do they?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Really? What's that connection?
Well, it's first of all, it's procrastinating the dealing with the addiction. I will do it later. I can do it at any time. It's not a problem.
Language is the same. I can quit any time.
Exactly. And addiction and procrastination, both of them produce a lot of guilt and shame. Addiction and guilt and shame are very best friends. They feed each other. So there's some similarities with this. But going back to your question, nowadays that everybody wants a pill, if someone will find a cure or medication for procrastination, there will be billionaires. So many people are affected, and the economy also affected a lot from people being procrastinated.
Yeah.
I mean, just think about, you know, what people produce and what they could have produced if they never procrastinated. If you could cancel the ping of the email or the WhatsApp or the Facebook. But the truth is that medication oftentimes deals with symptoms. And let's talk a little bit neurobiology in that. When we create change, first of all, we hate change. Our mind and our bodies hate change. They will always do everything they can to maintain what they have, even if it's not so great, but they will try to make the balance, the homeostasis, if you'd like. Change is something that we don't like doing. Change is very expensive to the body and to the mind. We have to use a lot of effort. Now, let's take an example. If here it was a lawn here, and I will go every day from here, from where I'm sitting now, to your spot, and I will walk there every day. And eventually, after a amount of time, I will create a path. This is exactly what happens in your brain when you do something again, again, again. This is the way we create habit. Only instead of the path in the lawn, we have neurological connections. And every time I walk that path, I strengthen them and make them denser, and I add some more neurons. It becomes very, very strong. And this is the habit that we talk about. This is the automatic habit, if you like. Now, one day I may change my mind and say, you know what, I'm going to walk from here to the other direction. So every time I'm going to walk there, I'm going to create a different path. This is the change of behavior. What's more important, that every day that I walk in the second path, it's another day that I'm not walking in this, in the original path. So what will happen eventually, that weeds will grow and the path will almost disappear. It never disappears. Our brain never forgets anything. I don't know if it's good or bad, but we don't forget. Maybe we don't have access to it, but we never forget anything. But the thing is that we can almost extend something, and we can create a new change. Now, medications won't do that. Medications will deal with symptoms. In order to have a change, you have to do you have to do either therapy or coaching or workshop. You have to change something in the thinking, in the behavior. And the more you will do it, the stronger it will get. I think I know people that medication did wonder for them. I mean, I will not preach against medication. But I think in most cases, and not the extreme levels, I don't think it should be the first line of therapy. There's so many other things that you can do. You may take medication in the beginning in order to have a clear table, right, and start doing the change. But there's no way around hard work. Hard work is our best friend.
Yeah. Right. So it comes with behavior change.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And I'm sure you've seen the recent studies on addiction that are showing how much it's a social based disease. Have you seen some of those articles?
Depends. Yes, I have seen. Depends on the drug. Oh, yeah. Or not only drug. I mean, sex is an addiction. Work is an addiction. Gambling is an addiction. There's many ways.
Right. Good point.
We can do that. But okay, go on with that.
Oh, no, I found it interesting. They were talking about the one with the rats where they gave the rats cocaine, and they found that the ones, when they were just alone with it, they really, really wanted it and got addicted to it. But when they were put in a situation where they had a lot of other rats and toys and everything going on there, mm-hmm. they actually lost interest in the cocaine. And so they're saying it's not just about the substance. It's not a chemical issue entirely. It's actually got a very strong emotional social component to it.
Oh, definitely. First of all, I'm very happy for the rat. Very happy. That's great. Yes, of course. I mean, it's the substance. Here's the thing with addiction, and we're going a little bit a different route, but addiction is the second problem, number two, you'll call it. There's always problem number one. Problem number one is my untreated depression, my failing marriage, a loss, trauma, you name it, something bad, something that I don't want to handle, something that when I'm sober is there and feels so bad that I have to take something to alleviate it because it feels like it will never go away. It feels like I have no control over it. This is problem number one. Problem number two,
right,
is the substance that takes it away, or the gambling, or the sex, or the work, or the vodka, or the cocaine, whatever it is. But if you treat only problem number two and you never treated problem number one, nothing will happen. It's, you know, it's exactly with culture hacking. When I did when I was working with people in detox, so we would say, okay, I'm free now. You know, I'm clean. I don't have the cravings anymore. I did it. I'm going to go home and everything's going to be great. Well, nothing's going to be great because all your problems are just waiting for you. Your annoying family and the job that you hate and your financial issues. Everything is just waiting for you to come back. If you don't have a new set of tools, if you don't have ways to deal with it, you will go back right to where you started from, because this is the way you protect yourself. So you cannot take a person and leave them bare and take away the addiction, because the addiction, the drug or whatever they're using, it's their best friend. It's their crutch. The thing that helps them survive in the world. You have to replace it. The same as culture hacking, you will replace a model with something that will make that model obsolete or irrelevant. You will do something else.
Yes.
So same here. You cannot just take away something. You have to replace it. You have to replace it with something better. And if that promotes your well-functioning. And if we'll go back to procrastination, instead of counting on your motivation, and motivation is very flaky, one day we have it, one day we don't.
Totally.
We cannot count on that. I can count, however, on habits. Habits is something efficient. Habits is something that happens automatically. Habits is something economical. I don't have to invest a lot of effort in habits because it's a habit. This is something reliable. This is something that will take me where I want to go.
It's really interesting. Yeah, just makes me think of certain habits I've done where for example, for me, meditation is one. Right now I'm doing it anywhere between 20 and 40 minutes a day.
Wow.
And I like it a lot. And there are times where I've done it where it was so maddening that I stopped, that I felt like it was making things worse than better. And, you know, there were certain times where I had like, okay, I'm going to do 20 minutes meditation, hour yoga, journaling, writing, this, that, you know, and I had those all stacked on. And then I just got so frustrated, you know, like, I'm like, just there's too many of these great habits. Like I don't feel like I'm living. And so I probably went to the extreme. But it's interesting for me that I totally agree. And maybe I didn't do things long enough to truly become a habit, but I've done them for, 30, 40 days and sometimes just thrown them out.
Mm-hmm. And that's fine. You know what? This is a space for trial and
experiment,
error.
Yeah.
Experimenting with that. But I got to tell you something, and it's about fun. And fun is something very underestimated, I think, especially if you talk to the so-called high-functioning people and say, oh, I have to do this, I have to do this. Fun? I should do some fun?
Yeah, I totally get that.
And
totally
it's very saturated with guilt. Like, why should I do fun? Fun is for children. Well, fun is very important. Oftentimes we will do things, I think mostly we will do things that are fun for us. I mean, we will do our duties and stuff. We will survive them. But the things that we will really stick into are the things that make us feel good. They are fun in some way. They fill some need it as it wants to be filled. Now, fun also is related to being in the present. And like meditation, or maybe more mindfulness, I would say. Mindfulness, oftentimes people think that mindfulness is detaching from everything. It's the exact opposite. Mindfulness is feeling everything and just sitting there and letting everything flow around you and not reacting to it or trying to control it. This is mindfulness, and it's extremely, extremely difficult. And I salute your 40 minutes of meditation because I'm not even close there. it's not easy. But it is, fun is basically being in the present. Now, when you think about it, who is best in being in the present?
Kids.
Exactly. Kids are masters of being in the present. They don't care about what happened in the past. They don't care about consequences. They don't plan. They don't feel bad about things that they didn't do well. They live in the present.
Yeah.
They enjoy it.
Yeah.
They are fully present there in the present. This is the reason it's called present. For adults, we oftentimes either live in the past, regretting things that we didn't do or yearning things that passed already, or planning for the future or dreading the future. Anxiety basically is worry, is fear and future. This is anxiety. It's worrying about something that is about to happen, that didn't happen, that may never happen.
Yeah.
This is the definition of it. But sometimes I would see people, adults, high-functioning ones, not necessarily the low-functioning, that they do nothing in the present, that nothing that is just for now, that has no functioning later on, like, I don't know, playing basketball or connecting with someone. And even if they do it, they always think about something else, or they check their phones constantly, or they do something else, or their mind is occupied with something else. And I think one of the best exercises is to have at least 20 minutes of the day that you do something that you're fully there. And for you, it may be the meditation. For some people, it's hiking. Some people just, sitting on the beach. But something that you're there. And it doesn't have to do anything with the past or the future. It's being right now and fully being there.
Mm.
Very, very important.
What do you do?
What do I do? Well, I play tennis.
Oh, yeah?
I play tennis. I run.
Oh, I find tennis so stressful. It's like every moment there's a win or a loss and you don't have anybody to support. It's just you out there. Like, to me, tennis was like this laboratory for self-hatred.
Well, that's one way to look at it. I would say tennis also, you have to be present. If you're not present, you won't last. You have to be there all the time. It's really intense enough to take away, all other thoughts and whatever it is that you had throughout your day.
Have you read Andre Agassi's autobiography?
No.
It's fascinating. As a psychologist, I think you'd love it.
I will definitely.
It's one of the best books I've ever read. Just as not only a sports biography, but a life biography. It's incredible.
Didn't he marry?
He was first
Brooke Shields.
First Brooke Shields, then they got divorced, and then now he's with Steffi Graf.
Oh, yeah, Steffi Graf.
Yeah, he tells the whole story of it all. It's really interesting.
Oh, I'm so going to read it.
Yeah, you'd love it. Cool. Well, we got to get wrapped up here. So what, for your practice, what is something that, what's a telltale sign that somebody would recognize in their lives before they would come to you? Like, what would you say if you're noticing this or this, like,
Or if you're addicted to something.
Yeah. If you can't live without, fill in the blank, come to me.
Yeah. And sometimes it's not can't live without, but just doing something that you're sure that you're able to stop any minute. But then when you reflect on it, you actually see that you invest much more time that you or resources that you want to admit. Then something like that. Do a lot of couples therapy right now, which I really like. With couples therapy, oftentimes the problem is that the couple arrives to therapy when the relationship basically died already. And you keep telling yourself, if they only came here 6 months ago, maybe we could have saved that. But some of them also come on time, and there's a lot of things that you can do. And procrastination, of course, this has a lot of internal and external costs. And many times people will not make the connection that their procrastination actually causes all the things in their life. When we think about a procrastinator, people think about these people who live these very chaotic lives with losing jobs and relationships and accidents. It's not necessarily so. Oftentimes you'll see it with very functioning people that they do well in most of aspects of their lives. But one aspect is chronically neglected, and that can be health or appearance or social world or career or self-fulfillment. This is something that they never get to. They procrastinate on it, and for that or this reason.
Cool. So, and I'm a big believer in that we're not only selective about who we choose, but we're also selective about our clients. Like, for example, for me, if people ask me to sell them on culture, I say, that's not really what I do. You know, I work with people who they want to have a deeper understanding of it, but they get that it's important, because if you're going to get me to try to figure out how the bottom line is going to be connected to this, that's not going to be enough of a motivator for you to do it. So if you're only looking for ROI connection to culture and you don't really feel passionate about it for the sake of culture, I'm probably not a good fit. So do you have anything like that where you'd say, you know, this is a good kind of client that we could have a good relationship with, and this is not the kind that I'm going to work with?
Well, I think I will give you a universal answer that all therapists will give you. You want people that want to change and are willing to work for change.
How can you tell? Like, or how would I be able to tell if I'm listening to this being like, because everybody probably thinks they are, or no, some people don't?
Not necessarily. I think when people come to therapy, you know, when I worked with addictions in the detox center, people have to hit really rock bottom, really, really be in a bad shape in order for them to admit that they cannot do it by themselves and that they need help. If we talk about in my private practice, usually we'll see people who don't feel good and they want to feel better. There's something that they don't want to live with it anymore. I mean, I don't know if you know, sometimes you talk to a person, you meet someone, an acquaintance, and you talk about this and that. And after like 3, 4, 5 years, you meet that person. And when you talk, they talk about the same things as if nothing happened, as if 5 years didn't pass and they still are waddling in the same puddles. Mm. And this is my message to the world. If you don't want to, you know, be in that same puddle and do the same thing and the stagnation, basically move on to something else, even, you know, even shift your conflicts, solve something or move on from something to something else. That's growth.
Yeah.
That's movement. Yeah. And this is something that therapy is very good at. If you feel like stuck and you cannot get out of it and you want to have a better quality of life, it's always good to do something. You can always change.
Nice. Nice. And where will they find you?
Well, I'm in Studio City.
Well, then I can just drive around Studio City. No, you have a website, an email address, something.
My email address. Okay, my email address is DR for doctor, S for Shirley, Aylor Asif, EYLOR ASIF. And I'm also on Psychology Today, or Good Therapy Directory is easily be reached.
Great. Great. Fantastic. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, it is a pleasure to have you on here, I think. And you know, I just want to say, too, that I'll sometimes get into this pattern of I'm dealing with something that's hard. I'll get support and then I'll be like, I'm good, like for the rest of my life, right? And then only later do I realize, wait a minute, I'm in a rut now, I need help. And I think it's good to have those outsourced, whether it be a therapist or a coach or a mentor or somebody who's there even when things are going well, I don't think you have to hit necessarily those ruts or deep ruts we keep going with these
kind of
things.
That's true. Though I like the way you said it. I mean, I like the independence of it. I get it. I'm moving on with myself. I think good therapy is all about making you independent. It's not that you're going to continue coming forever.
Totally.
Take what we do in therapy and apply it in your life and own it. Mm-hmm. And you can come back when you hit another challenge.
True.
Or a stone, yes. But definitely sending you off to do your thing.
All right, Culture Hackers. Well, I think this has been a fabulous podcast. A lot of information there to go do it. And I would say if there's something you're procrastinating on right now, do it. Just while you have the energy, while you're thinking about this, don't find something else to procrastinate about. Just do this because you might find it only takes 20 minutes what you've been thinking about for 3 weeks, right?
Yes.
All right. Okay, we'll see you next time.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, bye.